Welcome. We are here today with DJ McHale, who is the creator of Are You Afraid of the Dark, which is kind of our theme this week.
Among other things.
DJ, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome, guys. Let me clarify that, though. I'm actually the co-creator of Are You Afraid of the Dark.
Okay.
I also created the show with my good friend and partner, Ned Candle. So he and I are very much the guys who started Are You Afraid of the Dark together.
Right on.
So we're co-creators.
Okay. So one of the things that immediately struck me when we were doing our research for the show was that you grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut. I also grew up in Connecticut. And did you have any interest in writing growing up or in the supernatural?
Well, that's two different questions.
Okay.
interest in writing... I did, but didn't realize that I did.
Okay.
Because, I give presentations in schools all the time, and sure. One of the main things I talk about is that when I was a kid, I hated to write. but what I didn't realize, what I hated actually was the discipline of writing, of sitting down and putting words on a piece of paper.
Sure.
However, I was always a storyteller. I was
okay.
Always making up stories. So in a sense, that's just as much writing as sitting down putting words on a piece of paper. So I was always a storyteller from the time I was a little kid. In fact, I think it was third grade, maybe second grade, where I took a test, one of those long standardized tests you take where they ask you 100 random questions that make no sense.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And supposedly, based on that, you're supposed to know what you should do for a career. And this thing came out for me, writer.
Oh, wow.
And I was like,
so it worked.
I was like, no way, I'm not doing that. It's like for egghead. Yeah, it's great. So I hate to give more credibility to those tests than they deserve, but for me, it certainly worked.
Sure. How about the supernatural? I mean, you said you were a storyteller. I mean, did you like to tell scary stories? I mean,
I loved everything there was to do with scary stories.
Okay.
I was never much of a horror fan. I mean, flat out, grotesque horror. Not that there was that much of it back then.
Sure.
Some of the stories that I used to read all the time were these compilations by Alfred Hitchcock. Not that wrote any of them, but
right.
They just stuck his name on it, I'm sure. But there were all these classic tales of ghost stories and macabre stories, stories like The Birds, Daphne du Maurier's Birds, that the movie was based on.
Sure.
The Monkey's Ball, which I based on Are You Afraid of the Dark episode on.
Yeah.
I remember one called The Upper Berth, about a haunted cabin in a ocean liner.
Mm-hmm.
I love those stories, and all the comics that went with it, like the Creepy and the Eerie magazines. I'd always read that stuff.
Right.
And my buddy Frank and I, they used to be a horror matinee at the Embassy Theater in Portchester, New York, on Saturdays. And I always when I thought of The Tale of Midnight Madness, which was one of the Are You Afraid of the Dark episodes,
sure,
I always think we used to go to the. Of course, then it was Noon Madness. Doesn't have a ring to it. So we go to these icky horror movies that were always—they were made in like Yugoslavia, Italy, and you know, stuff that you would never see on TV and whatnot.
Sure.
At all. So I, you know, as to why I was drawn to that stuff, I have no idea. But I was, and so it just kind of came natural when I started writing that way.
Right on.
This may go without saying, but were you much into Poe, like in English class and stuff?
A little bit. I read a lot of it. I will say that I often, not to jump too quickly to Are You Afraid of the Dark, but one of the things they asked us to do at Nickelodeon was they were so afraid that parents would freak out that we were terrifying their kids.
Sure.
As a kind of a backpedaling position, they said, base some of your stories on the literary antecedents.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, if they got complaints... They'd say, what are you talking about? This is classic stuff. And
yeah,
I went into Poe. I tried hard.
Sure.
Go to the Poe stories, and I did nothing ever translated into something for young people.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes really good sense. So to kind of jump ahead a little bit, after you graduated high school, you studied at NYU. Is that correct?
Yeah, there was a step in between that.
Okay.
I didn't know what the heck. I made films all the way through high school, films and videos.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But I never thinking I'd do it as a career
because
it was too much work. And so I actually went to Villanova University right out of high school.
Okay.
Not knowing why. A couple of my cousins went there. I was like, okay, fine. Yeah, I have to go to college. Why not?
Sure.
And So yeah, you know, I had this vague notion, maybe I'll be a lawyer. Like, you're right. So, but I remember I had an epiphany, and it was Friday morning in class, somewhere probably around November, mm-hmm. and it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and I was, let's just say, I wasn't in any good shape to be there.
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know who listens to your podcast, but...
People who can relate.
People who can, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. No business being in there. And I was sitting there going, oh, God, what am I doing here? And it's like the light bulb went on, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm paying for this.
Sure.
This isn't high school anymore. What am I doing here? This is crazy. Where am I going? Suddenly I had like this life opening. And I started questioning, what am I doing? And it was my girlfriend at the time who said, you know, I don't know what you're doing, but one thing you used to love was making movies.
Right.
So why don't you go to film school? It's like, you know, you're right. So that's when I transferred to NYU Film School to get into film.
That's interesting, because I know, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, that we've come up with that have very similar stories where they've started in something that, you know, they just had no business doing, and then it kind of, a bulb just went off one day. Yeah, that's really interesting.
It's
interesting to know that came from a hangover.
Yeah, right.
Going into the film school stuff, did you have an area of concentration, or was it just kind of general studies?
Well, at NYU, I don't know what it's like today, but what you went for was your BFA in film production, Bachelor of Fine Arts. And I was kind of fortunate in that, you know, it's not just a film school. You get your college degree there.
Sure.
So you have to take a lot of, you know, regular courses, too. And fortunately, I took most of those at Villanova in a year and a half.
Yeah.
So for me, it really kind of was like film school. And, you know, I had this vague notion that I wanted to be a director.
Mm-hmm.
And because writing, again, was just too laborious for me. I just couldn't sit in that chair. I didn't think I was very good anyway. So, you know, I wanted to be a director. And the way it works in that school is that you come up with projects. As you're in your later years, you come up with projects and kind of pitch them, just like you do in real life, to see if you can actually make a big film, not just the, you know, the little exercise films that everybody makes.
Yeah.
Right.
And I also took a writing course, and because you have to take them, and I took a couple of them, but I took this one in particular, and it was the first time that this professor, I think she was a professor, teacher, whatever, who really kind of made me understand that, you know, writing actually isn't as laborious as I think it is. It can actually be fun.
Sure.
She's the one that kind of opened up the door for me to say, you know, you've got more to say than you think you do.
Right, right.
So I took the route of saying, okay, to get into the film business, I'll do it through writing.
Okay.
And that was a definite decision. So other than getting one of my films made that I wrote and directed in school, I didn't really have a specific, you know, concentration. It wasn't like I was a cinematography concentration or
right.
editing concentration.
Right.
I was a writer. Well, maybe I did. I was a writing directing concentration. So
okay.
Maybe I did. But the degree is the same, no matter what you concentrate on.
Right. You mentioned, you know, writing and you know, some of the faculty there. I wonder if you could tell us what it was like studying under Pat Cooper.
Well, Pat Cooper was that professor I was talking about. She was a woman. She was a woman who. Okay, you know, Wikipedia is great.
Right.
It's studied under Pat Cooper. I think they think Pat Cooper is that comedian.
Right.
It wasn't that Pat Cooper.
Sure,
it was
sure.
a completely different Pat Cooper.
Okay.
She was like, I never saw her since.
Oh, okay,
but,
wow.
Well, yeah, but she was...
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned that she found a way to make writing not work anymore. Can you think of anything that she said or did that got you to think about it in a different way?
Well, yeah, actually, I have an answer to that. It was, and it's so simple. It was a writing exercise that we did in class one day.
Yeah.
And this wasn't a writing exercise that was designed to open any doors for anyone.
Sure.
It's just a writing exercise. Turns out people do these kinds of writing exercises all the time.
Sure.
And in fact, I now do that exercise when I do writing workshops and whatnot. I do that exercise with young people. Hopefully, it's fun to do anyway, but hopefully it'll kind of open doors for other people too. And what that exercise is she gave us four lines of dialogue between character A and character B.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember what they were. but it was it set up a conflict between character A and character B. And then the exercise is keep going right from there for 15 minutes. And there are only two rules. Don't think and don't stop.
Yeah,
right.
That's good.
Just let it go. Don't edit yourself. Don't say, "Oh, how about if I do that? What if he says, you know what?" And take, let it go wherever it takes you. And in that 15 minutes, it was so much fun. I ended up with 8 pages of stuff that I just streamed off, you know, the top of my head.
Right.
And I read it back. I was like, "Wow, this is kind of fun and this is kind of good."
Right.
So it's like, "Wow!" So it really was that one day in that one class. And frankly, I don't remember anything else about that class except for that day.
Okay. Sure.
Did this technique end up translating into a lot of other projects? Like, that's kind of how you would start stories, or was it kind of varied from thing to thing?
Yes and no, maybe not. I mean, I don't, it's rare that I'll just let loose like that, just start writing.
Sure.
But what I will do is kind of put my head into the head of the character that I'm writing about.
Yeah.
And just kind of imagine what it's like. What are they going through? What are they doing? How am I feeling? How is what's happening making me feel? And so in that way, it's kind of the same thing. It's a little bit freeform. It's a little more regimented than that, but than that class was.
Right.
But it really is. It did teach the ability of just, you know, let your imagination go. That's the main thing.
Sure.
It's like don't constantly second guess yourself. Don't overthink it. One of the things that I do all the time, and a lot of authors don't, frankly. But I do, and that is, I outline things.
Uh-huh.
And when I outline is too formal a word for it, because it sounds like, you know, A, 1B,
sure.
4. You know, it's not like that. It's just a way of taking notes on your thought process.
Yeah.
When I'm writing a new book, because I'm an author now, one of the things I do is, the most fun times for me is when I sit down to outline a new book.
Sure.
Because it's words that no one's ever going to read.
Right.
And it's so easy to change, and you can really arc out the whole thing. When I worked on Are You Afraid of the Dark, the first time I would work with writers, they would hate me. because I would put them through the ringer on the outline of a script. We would go through draft after draft after draft of outline.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that everything, every story beat worked, and we've gone out, and they're like, I know what they're thinking. They're like, oh my God, this guy's killing me. We haven't even started the script yet.
Yeah.
But then, when we got to the script, they usually only wrote one draft.
Oh, wow.
Because all the work was done.
Right.
That was it. Done. I mean, I would then take it and totally rewrite it.
But
after that, they wanted to work with me because we did all of our grunt work with words that no one would ever read except the two of us.
Sure, sure.
That's really cool. Yeah, I like that.
You didn't have to. I mean, there's that old standard phrase of, look, you're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
Right.
We weren't rearranging deck chairs. We were looking for icebergs.
Sure.
And so in some ways, that's really, I think maybe that stems a little bit from that writing exercise.
Right.
Maybe not directly, but I think it does a little bit.
Yeah.
Kind of inching up towards Are You Afraid of the Dark, what were some of your first jobs out of college? I mean, did you make the move to L.A. or did you work in New York? I mean, what kind of things did you find yourself doing?
Well, you know the term waiter's job.
Yeah.
You know, actors get that waiter's job to make ends meet while they're trying to do acting. Well, I was fortunate. I mean, right out of college, what I started to do was write screenplays.
Okay.
That thing I was going to do. But you can't make money writing screenplays.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, we know.
not easily, anyway.
Not usually. You know the feeling. You can't make you can't pay the rent on, I've got a great idea for a screenplay.
Yep.
Right.
So while I was doing that, I was very fortunate in that my waiter's job was actually in the film business.
Oh, wow.
What I did, still in New York. I was living in Connecticut, but working in Connecticut, New York. I don't know how many years, 5, 6 years or something, maybe more than that, I wrote, directed, and produced industrial films.
Okay.
Corporate videos, how-to films, public service announcements, TV commercials. And the thing that was so great about it is when I was making, you know, a meager living, it was not too bad, but I was also learning how to take volumes of information and present them in kind of a clever, fun way.
Sure.
Yeah.
So certainly that helped in my writing itself, but also one of the things I say to young writers all the time is I say, gee, should I go to college and study writing? And I say, no. you should go to college, study everything else,
right,
and then write about it.
That's great advice. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, cause anybody can become a writer. I mean, sure. If you have the discipline, that's the big if.
Right.
If you have the discipline, you can sit down and you can teach yourself to write. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of arduous work, but you can do it. But that's only half the battle. The other half is to have something interesting to write about.
Right.
So in that 5, 6, 7 years, whatever it was, I was making these videos and films, I traveled all over the country. I met so many different kinds of people, so many different types of places. It was like, without realizing it, I was filling up my hard drive of experience and information that I've called on for years ever since in my writing. All the while at night, I'm writing screenplays on my off days to try to get sold. And the real kind of breakthrough came through. I always say to young writers is that you can't necessarily choose the kind of things you want to write.
Right.
You have to find out what's inside before you can decide what to come out. And here's the tricky part. What you like to read or what you like to see isn't necessarily what's going to come out of you.
Sure.
That may be part of it. But like, for example, I love comedies.
Uh-huh.
I cannot write comedy. It doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah.
So all these things, I mean, I pitched sitcoms, adult sitcoms and adult shows and adult movies, and I was getting nowhere until a friend of mine said, "You ever think about writing for kids?" And I was like, "Well, no, but I'll give it." But I turned my head that way, and suddenly all these ideas started coming out, and that's when I started getting jobs. I first started writing ABC After School specials.
Okay,
wow,
which have been on forever.
Sure.
The way I met my partner Ned, who I did Are You Afraid of the Dark with, he hired me to write the TV version of Encyclopedia Brown, Boy Detective.
Okay.
Which is on HBO.
I may have seen one of those.
Yeah. I recall Encyclopedia Brown for sure.
It was, well, you probably remember the books more than the movies, but or the TV shows. But it was on HBO back in the late 80s. In fact, it was really funny. I just heard something recently, probably because this new book came out called Slimed.
Okay.
Which is about the history of Nickelodeon.
Uh-huh.
And they're saying how Nickelodeon coined the term tween. There's a tween. The tweens are like, uh-uh. we were referring to Encyclopedia Brown. This is 1988, maybe. We were referring to Encyclopedia Brown as a tween show back in the late 80s.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it predated the heyday of Nickelodeon.
Yeah. Right.
So when Ned and I did that show together, or I did that show for Ned, then it was after that we said, hey, let's try to come up with some shows for ourselves. Are You Afraid of the Dark was one of those shows.
Right before we get into Are You Afraid of the Dark, one of the standouts on your resume was a 2-episode writing gig on the Toxic Crusaders.
We hope this is more accurate than the Pat Cooper thing.
But I was wondering, like, were you aware of Troma, and were you aware of the source material before this gig, and how did that kind of come about? Because this is kind of, our audience would definitely like to know about this, for sure.
Well, I'll actually give you some information, some little insider tip on that.
Okay.
The way it came about was, one thing I learned is that when something gets on IMDb,
right,
you can't take it off.
Right.
But if you look up Toxic Crusaders on IMDb, you'll find another writer on there. Not my episodes.
Okay.
But on other episodes. And if I'm getting thrown under the bus, I'll throw him under the bus too. It's a guy by the name of Chuck Lorre, who's going on to create
2 and a Half Men.
Yeah. He did some Toxic Crusaders.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I don't know Chuck. I'd never met him. But,
sure.
The way it came about was my partner Ned,
okay.
The guy who I detected B. Brown for. I don't know what his connection was, but he said, these guys want me to write this comic based on a TV show. I mean, based on a movie.
Right.
Does he want to do it? I'm like, I guess I could use the money. Yeah, it was fine.
Ned is to blame for this whole debacle.
Yes, he is after. But now, the insider thing I'll give you on that, beyond the Chuck Lorre, is that the movie Toxic Avenger.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Troma was, still is, I think, a film company that's known for doing, you know, movies on a dime.
Yep.
Yeah.
Really cheesy, campy,
and
horror
being
movies.
Very exploitative.
Yes, exactly. Well, good word, good choice of words, because, oh gosh, now I'm saying it and I'm forgetting his name.
Lloyd Kaufman?
No. A guy I went to NYU with.
Okay.
I'm blanking on his name. But he wrote The Toxic Avenger.
Oh, really?
And he's not, by trade, he's not, I don't know what he's doing today. I haven't seen him in years. But he's a camera guy. He's an electrician, you know, a film electrician.
Uh-huh.
And he had this idea, and he wrote The Toxic Avenger. Basically, I think Troma just stole it from him. And took it. I don't even think he gets screen credit for it.
Oh,
I kept
wow.
wrong about that. But yeah, he wrote the original Toxic Avenger. But yeah, so I knew about it. I don't think I've ever seen the movie all the way through. But by the time I got on that project, Toxic Crusaders, the guys at whatever the company was that were making it, they had already created all those characters. They had already created the situations and whatnot. And they were just looking for writers to come up with goofy story ideas and write the story ideas. So
sure.
A lot of it was given to me. It wasn't like, we'll come up with, here's a Toxic Avenger, come up with an idea. People had already come up with the idea for the cartoon of the Toxic Crusaders. I just ran with it from there.
Sure. Well, that was just kind of a quirky little thing. And I was like, I cannot pass this up.
It's not very good.
No, I mean, that was another show that I grew up with, and recently we went back and watched them, and it was just like, wow, these have not stood the test of time.
But I do have the action figure anyway.
Yeah, oh, yeah, awesome. We've got the full line of action figures still. could you tell us a little bit about the genesis of Are You Afraid of the Dark and how it almost didn't happen?
Yeah, sure. Well, Ned and I were together from Encyclopedia Brown.
Oh, Ned.
And it turned out not to be a great experience for reasons I won't say.
Okay.
That show should have gone on for a long time because it was a pretty good show.
Mm-hmm.
And people at HBO loved it, and it didn't go on for personality reasons. Not having to do with Ned or I. It's having to do with other people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Basically, people at HBO said, yeah, we can't stand dealing with this particular person anymore, so
okay. Goodbye.
Okay. So, which is unfortunate, which is, you know, kind of a tale of how things get done or not done in Hollywood a lot.
Right.
So Ned and I said, you know, let's try to come up with something ourselves. And Ned had a production company. He was doing all sorts of other stuff. So he was doing sports films and all that kind of stuff. So we had two separate careers. So he and I came up with an idea that was originally intended to be for direct-to-video. You know, back then it was called direct-to-video,
right,
then it became direct-to-DVD, now it's streaming. You know?
Video on
back
demand.
Then,
right.
Video on demand, right. Back then it was direct-to-video. And the idea was bedtime stories for lazy parents.
Okay.
And what we were going to do is, the idea was to get some old-time actor,
mm-hmm.
we didn't know who, you know, somebody who was out of work, but everybody recognized, and we'd shoot him in this big old stuffed chair, in front of a roaring fire, like a grandfatherly type person.
Yeah.
And he'd have a big book that said fairy tales. And we just have him read fairy tales.
Sure.
And we'd tape these things and we put a package together. And the idea was that we'd sell them directly to parents who were lazy, you know, and wanted, they didn't feel like reading a story. Now I'm a dad, so I know the feeling. It's like sometimes you just don't feel like reading that book again for the 12th time.
Sure.
So the idea kind of sounded really good, and then it came to the next step, which was, well, what kind of stories are we going to tell? And that became more problematic, because it was like, well, we do like public domain stuff, like Little Red Riding Hood,
right?
Yeah.
Little Pigs, you know, that's kind of boring, you know, it's kind of silly, and then it got to a whole rights issue. What, I don't know, then it sounded kind of dull, and I remember one day Ned asked me, he said, what kind of stories did you like when you were a kid? I said, well, I like scary stories. Like, oh, okay. So suddenly fairy tales became scary tales.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, can't have an old guy sitting in a chair reading scary tales because that's just creepy. So, because we didn't want the storyteller to be the scary part. You know, we didn't want the crypt keeper to be telling these things.
Right, yeah.
So it was like, okay, what do we do? Okay, what situation where you tell tales does it happen when the the tale teller isn't scary. It's like, well, sitting around a campfire.
Uh-huh.
I was like, okay, and told by kids. I was like, okay, let's have kids sitting around a campfire telling scary stories, and that'll be it. But then we start, the more we realize it, it's like, well, this is better and bigger than we think it is.
Uh-huh.
And the show was called Scary Tales at that time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote a 3-page presentation, you know, a pitch for it, and said what we wanted to do. And at that point, I don't even know if it was called the Midnight Society or not, but maybe it was, I don't remember. But we took it to Nickelodeon, and we pitched it, and we said, this is what we want to do, and they were horrified.
Yeah, they
were just like, no, you can't scare little kids. You can't do this. Uh-uh, it's not going to work. Forget it. Bye-bye. And so they basically kicked us out.
Right. Yeah.
And about a year later, and I'm really paraphrasing the story just to make it simple.
Sure.
Ned and I and a third fellow by the name of Gary Cohn had created another show called Crisscross, which we took to Nickelodeon and said, oh, we'd like to do this show. And they said, no, we don't want to do that show either. But in the year that we had first pitched Scary Tales, a new fella had been hired at Nickelodeon, a fellow by the name of Jay Mulvaney,
mm-hmm.
who was a development guy there. And he was literally going through the files, and he picked out my original 3-page pitch for uh-huh. Scary Tales. And in fact, I wasn't even in that meeting, frankly. It was just Ned and Gary. And as they're leaving, they're like, yeah, we don't want this Crisscross thing, but is anyone doing that Scary Tales show yet? And they were like, you know, of course, they were like, yeah, a lot of people are interested in that. You're like, nobody. So essentially they said, well, let's think about this, but we don't like the title. I come up with another title. So they came back to me, and Ned came back to me and said, we got to come up with another title. I'm like, okay, more Nickelodeon-like.
Right, yeah.
I was like, all right, what am I going to do? I was like, Scary Tales. It's like the perfect title, Scary Tales. So I started thinking, I was like, what am I going to come up with? And there was a Dr. Seuss book, still is, frankly, called The Sneetches and Other Stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember about the yellow things with the stars on their bellies?
Yep. Yeah, star belly sneech.
I wrote a paper on that once, so yeah, I definitely remember that.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did.
I had that when I was a little kid, but there were 4 stories in that book. The fourth story was a story about pale green pants with no one inside them. About the old Dr. Seuss character. You remember that?
Yeah. Yes.
It was called What Was I Scared Of?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I went back to that title, What Was I Scared Of? That's a cool title, What Was I Scared Of? Because that's what we're talking about. What was I scared of? Well, I was afraid of clowns, but the scary clown show is demented. You can't do that. So it's like, scary. Well, I was afraid of the dark. Am I afraid of the dark? Who's afraid? Are you afraid of the dark? So the title, Are You Afraid of the Dark, came from What Was I Scared Of?
Right.
Huh. And we went back to Nickelodeon. We shot the pilot. And they're like, okay, go ahead. You got a series, and that's essentially how it started. But it almost, you're right, it almost didn't happen because they originally turned it down because it was just scary. And now there are other scary shows on TV. I'll venture to say that nothing like Are You Afraid of the Dark has ever been.
No.
Yeah.
That's definitely one of the things we wanted to touch on a little bit later on was kind of the landscape of television today. But Cameron and I both have fond memories of the very first episode. I mean, for me, I went trick-or-treating, and I had remembered seeing the commercials beforehand, and I came home from trick-or-treating in 1991 and sat down in front of the television and saw that very first episode. You know, and Cam, I think you were the same.
That's pretty much my story as well, just gorging myself on candy while watching. I just remember very vividly the part where... The guy wishes that his friend would win the race,
and
the dog comes out from behind the tree and trips the kid. Like, I just, that's very vivid.
But to go along with that, I mean, what was the initial response like after that first episode?
Well, when they told me that it was going to air on Halloween night, tells you what I know, I was livid. I was like, seriously, we're going to air the show. The entire future of the show rests on the fact of how it's going to do on a night when no kid is going to be home watching television.
Yeah, yeah. It shows you.
You got to be kidding me. But they were right, I guess, because kids did exactly what you did.
Sure.
They went after reading, and then it was on late enough that they came back. And I have to be honest with you, after years of rejection, just getting little things done here and there, I never thought in a million years the show was going to be picked up, the series. So much so that after I shot that pilot, I was living in Connecticut. We shot the pilot in Montreal, Canada. I was sitting there going, we did the pilot for the show Crisscross as well, and we're waiting. Mm-hmm. And I also wrote the pilot for a TV series called Ghostwriter, which was on PBS.
Mm-hmm. I also remember that.
And so here we've got these three things sitting there that like these are going nowhere. Like, if I got to be serious about this TV thing, I'm moving to Los Angeles.
Right.
So that's when I moved to Los Angeles, only to find out that all three shows got picked up. they asked me to be the head writer on Ghostwriter, but I couldn't. Because, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I could have, but I didn't create that show. The other two shows I created. Crisscross was picked up for Showtime and shot in Nottingham, England.
Okay.
And Very Afraid of the Dark was shot in Montreal. So I became George Clooney from up in the air, constantly living on planes, going back and forth. I'm trying to remember exactly where and when I was when they said, you know, you're going to go to series here. I don't remember.
That's understandable considering how busy you were.
Sure.
Yeah, it was just so long ago that if I remember correctly, it was just like, really? We're really going to make the show? Because it seemed like it was going on for so long. And it was. I mean, we created that show a couple of years before.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things about the film business of making films is that there's rarely that moment where you can pop a champagne cork.
Right, right.
It's always, we're going to pick it up, but I don't know. You know, let's try it. So you're always like, are we really doing this?
Sure,
I don't know. Really going with it. But I'll tell you one thing, a real personal thing. I immediately jumped into doing the show. And that show, I put that show on my back, especially in that first couple of seasons, mm-hmm. and did everything on those shows.
Right.
And there was one day, and it's just so much work. It was the hardest thing I ever did, but also the most gratifying. But there was one day where I was standing by myself in the center of the soundstage. And it was our soundstage for the whole season. And we had about five different sets being built on the soundstage. There was Dr. Vink's cottage.
Oh, right on.
There was Zeebo's funhouse with the doors above the number.
Yes.
There was the bedroom from The Lonely Ghost with the two-way mirror with the Help Me on the wall.
Yeah.
There were all these things. And I'm sitting there looking at all these things, and I just remember thinking, this is really cool.
So
of all this stuff.
Sure.
It took a little bit to sink in, like, you know, we're doing it, I'm doing it, you know. It took to get to that moment, I guess.
Well, it just, because when you're faced with it, it's like, I remember hearing an interview once with Larry David, and I could so relate to what he said, where he said each year when he got the news that there was going to be a pickup, the new pickup for the Seinfeld season, the next season,
uh-huh.
that, like, and I'm forgetting his exact words, but basically his first reaction was, oh, that's great. His second reaction was like, he wanted to jump out of a window.
Yeah,
because,
sure.
Because there's so much work to be done. So when you're in the middle of it, all you can think of is that next thing. I remember when I sat down with Gary, the guy who I did Crisscross with, he was actually brought on as one of the producers of the first season of Are You Afraid of the Dark? And I remember I'd never done a series before. I'd written Encyclopedia Brown.
Right.
But I didn't produce it. I just wrote a bunch of scripts and sent them away. And I was never responsible for delivering a series before. And I remember sitting down with Gary with one of those big dry erase calendars.
Uh-huh.
And we're like, okay, let's figure out the schedule for the show. So we started, the first show we shot was Phantom Cab.
Okay.
And we said, okay, we're gonna shoot this in 5 days. Okay, fine. Okay, we're gonna shoot here, and then we're gonna have X amount of time of editing. Let's pad this a little bit. Have X amount of time of editing, and then we're gonna go. Then we have to have approvals built in. You know, we're writing this all down on the dry erase board, and then we have to do sound. We're okay. Then do the sound. And so we plan out this really very cushy schedule.
Sure.
And right down to when the day we had to deliver it, and we looked at it. And we're like, no, that's not so bad. We didn't do that.
Right.
And then at the same time it hit us, it's like, oh, but then there's another episode the next week.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
You got to do this every week.
So suddenly we had to take that and put an entire another episode on top of that.
Right.
And another episode. And then suddenly it's like, yeah, I'm ready to jump out the window. How are we going to do this? This is crazy.
But in talking, I guess in talking about that, just quickly, I mean, was there a set budget per episode? I mean, did every episode have the same budget?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we had, that was it. And we had next to nothing.
Right. Sure.
It was ridiculous the kind of money we had. We had to big borrow and steal to do stuff. Mm. In what I would end up doing, and that's one of the reasons why the first season kind of looks as cheesy as it does. I mean, I think the stories are really good.
Yeah.
If I do say so myself, I think the stories are good, but the production values aren't the greatest in the world.
Right.
What I started doing after that, I got smart. Uh-huh. Is when I knew there was going to be another season, I would fly to Montreal, and I would go to my location scout and say, show me cool places.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just show me great things. And she was like, okay, I don't know what you're looking for. And she just take me all over the city and show me these cool places and what happened. That would give me the inspiration for episodes.
Sure.
So the one that jumps to mind was she took me to this 1940s era water purification plant.
Okay.
And it was all this old technology and these big series of tanks, vats underwater. I was like, wow, this is really cool. I was like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if, like, this was like, they were, like, growing, like, incubators down here, growing animals down here, growing monsters down
here.
Sure,
yeah.
And out of that came the idea for the episode we did called The Hatching.
Oh, right,
and,
yeah.
And so if I had just sat in my room and said, ooh, I have an idea about a school that's on top of a giant incubator for lizards. We had to then go out and find that.
Right.
We never could have done it. It wouldn't have happened.
Right.
But so I go to my production designer. He'd look at his script and he'd say, what, are you crazy? And I say, no, we got it. We already, don't worry about it.
Right.
That's already there. So that's one of the ways we were able to get a lot of production value on this on the page, because the budgets are small. They went up over the years incrementally, but
sure,
still was not a lot of money at all.
Well, I mean, you know, that first season, you know, you say that about production value, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, we've gone back and watched the first season recently, and I mean, there's some of the best, you know, stories in that season. The Tale of Laughing in the Dark and the Dark Music and the Pinball Wizard. I mean, all of those seem to still have, you know, really great production value to them.
Well, thank you. I'll take issue with that, but yeah, I'll take the compliment. Sure, fine.
Pinball Wizard is the one that a lot of, in talking to other people, like, hey, what do you want us to talk to him about? That kind of stuff. Pretty much everybody's mentioned Pinball Wizard. One of the most memorable episodes.
Well, in a good way?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just been one of those things, because it's, you know. And we'll get into this, but, I mean, it's one of those that doesn't necessarily have the happiest ending.
Right.
And it's just, those were the episodes, especially in that first season, that kind of stood out. In talking about production, a lot of the episodes, you know, feature complicated character designs and creature designs and effects, not to mention an original score for every episode. I mean, that, you know, you're talking about your schedule, I mean... Was there ever any time where you were just like, there's no way we're going to get this in on time?
Oh, no. No.
Oh.
There was never a meet a deadline problem.
Okay.
There were plenty of, we're never going to be able to pull this off.
Sure, sure.
You mentioned two areas in particular that we got so incredibly lucky on. When there's a woman that we hired in the first season, her name's Anique Chartier, who was a makeup artist.
Okay.
And she, up until that point, she had done a little bit of she mostly did on-camera television stuff. And I know she worked locally in Montreal. And she was very, very young and didn't have a whole lot of experience. And so she was hired by the producer, the local producer said to her, you know, it's basically just a bunch of kids. You may have to do some clown makeup on one of those episodes. You know, it's not that big a deal.
Sure.
But in talking to her, I learned that she had this real interest in doing effects makeup.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
And so suddenly, the stuff that she did for that show, we had no business having the kind of stuff we had on that show.
Sure.
Over the, she worked for the first 5. I think she might have worked through into the 7th season.
Okay.
The thing, she, I mean, she's making ears in her kitchen. She's doing stuff, and she's learning as she's going along.
Right.
So the stuff that we got was, I mean, she is so much, she's entirely responsible for the look of so many of those creatures on that show. She designed all of those things. This is one person who did all of that.
Sure.
Was this another case of, like, the location scouting where things were inspired by, you know, the resources you had to work with rather than an idea you just came up with?
Well, maybe not. Yes, but maybe not directly. Like, it's not like she came to me and say, "Hey, I can do a really good gopher." You know, it wasn't like that.
Sure.
It was more like, I've got somebody who can do some cool stuff, so I can kind of let my imagination go a little bit more.
So right? When, where, I mean, like, in coming up with, because this was actually a question from one of our listeners. She was wondering, where did you come up with the ideas for character designs? You know, like the ghastly grinner and the water creature in Dead Man's Float. And the Crimson Clown, I mean, was that a teamwork thing, or did you have a very specific thing, or was she coming up with stuff? How did that work?
Teamwork.
Okay.
I mean, it always started with me or with the writer.
Sure.
Ghastly Grinner in particular was written by a guy by the name of Ron Oliver, who directed a lot of the episodes, actually. And I think that was the only one he wrote. He wrote and directed that one. And he had this idea for the Ghastly Grinner. Now, the actual creation of the Ghastly Grinner itself, you know, it started with the script. It started with Ron's idea and the way we talked about it. And I always work with the writers on all the ideas and get it to a point where it makes sense. And then it goes to the various department people. In this case, it was Anique and makeup.
Right.
And she'd have discussions with the director and with me of how it's going to go. So it's definitely a team effort of, well, how about this? How about that color? How about this color? So it's a team effort. That's one of the great things. The best way to make yourself look good as a director is to hire people who are really good at what they do and listen to them. So you may have some vague notion about, how about if I make this? If they're good, they're going to say, okay, I hear what you want. How about if we do it like this?
Sure.
Go, wow. So the department heads make it better than you could ever imagine it being. That's when you know you're hitting on all cylinders. That happened with music, too. There are two guys who did the majority of the shows, Jeff Fisher and Ramon Febi, who were, I mean, they scored all those things themselves. I put those guys to the ringer, though. That was, music was important to me in that show. It is an all horror type shows because you're often telling the story through music.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah.
You're creating the tension. And those poor guys. They had to go back to the drawing board so many times. Because of me, and I feel bad, but I think it came out okay in the long run, and they both did this fabulous job.
Sure.
So, but yes, in general, the story will start with the writer and with me, and then it's on the page, and then it goes to one of my favorite things on Are You Afraid of the Dark was the department head table read.
Okay,
and it's where I would sit at the beginning of a season. I would sit with the costume person, the makeup person, not the music person, but the set designer, the art director, the location scout, all those people. We'd sit at this table, and we would, and I'd read the script to them.
Sure.
And that was my chance for me to tell them what I had in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it was not that easy because I was in a French-speaking environment.
Okay.
And our fabulous production designer, and his name's, I can't believe it's Rial Proulx. Rial Proulx is just a genius. So much of what you see on screen comes out of his imagination, his head.
Sure.
But it's English, it's a second language.
Sure.
So at one point he came up to me and says, DJ, I cannot do this. I don't have the budget for this. I can't do it. I'm like, what? And he showed it to me, and I wrote a description and said, the room was turned upside down. And what I meant was, it was trash.
Sure.
And he thought, I can't start putting tables on the ceiling. I can't afford to do this.
It's like an Inception style.
But you're right, exactly. One of the things that came out of those meetings was, it's a phrase that I use all the time now, and I use it in my writing, in my books now, too. It's the "and here we go" moment.
Uh-huh.
We would sit around, we read the stories, and usually the beginnings of the stories, maybe there might be a little set piece in the beginning, but normally it's kind of set up.
Right.
You know, it's like you're learning about that character, about that monster. It's like getting all the gears set up. and then there's a moment where all the gears click into place.
Yeah,
sure.
And our first assistant director, Jacques Laberge, who also directed some episodes, who's the guy who has to keep the blade spinning, you know, he's the guy that got to keep the production going. He looked in the room and say, "And here we go," which had us turn the pages, and here's we start shooting all night.
Sure.
Because there's so much going on.
Well, that's great.
I've got a real quick thing, though. You know how it's almost like a director's cliche to say that if you've cast it right, you've done half your job or something to that effect. But I guess what I'm getting from the past 5 minutes or so is that goes for your whole crew, too. That goes for your entire art department, you know, your musicians, composers, whatever. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Oh, my God. I mean, that's one of the things that most people think that movies and TV are made by actors.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you know, they don't realize just how many people are slaving to the bone. And, you know, there's that old sports adage that says, you know, your team is only as strong as the weakest link.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the case in sports teams because the weakest link sits on the bench.
Yeah. But
in this case, it's true. Everybody has something to say. Everybody has something to do. And if you can get your crew involved and caring about it, then they'll go that extra 9 yards to do something more. There's one episode I remember in particular where it was called The Guardian's Curse, where there was a mummy thing in a museum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had to do the basement of a museum, and we had to stock it with stuff that looked like the basement of a museum. And, you know, every time you get something, it costs money to get it.
Sure.
Or you have to make it or whatever. And one of our our second grips on the show, was driving to work one day, and he saw a bunch of boxes that had been abandoned on the sideline. They were TEA boxes. And these really cool boxes that are wood, but they actually have metal bands around them and all the seams and whatnot. And they really jumped out. And he knew the script enough to say, "Hey, I bet we can use these to decorate the lobby." And he came to work with a truckload of these boxes. Man, so if you ever watch Guardian's Curse, look in that basement. All those tea boxes came from the second grip who said, "Hey, I think we could use this thing."
That's
you don't
fantastic.
Really get that.
No, I was just thinking, I mean, those things rarely ever happen on set. You know, I mean, that's insanity.
Well, as a follow-up, and I don't want to get into a huge thing about this, but, like, how did you get your crew to care? Like, how do you get a grip to be motivated to do something like that? Or was it, it just happened?
Well, two things. One is it's about casting, like you said. It's about hopefully, but you never know. I mean, one of the beauties of hiring freelance people is that if it doesn't work out, you don't rehire them.
Right. Yeah. Sure.
So when the second season comes, you know who to hire and rehire.
Yeah.
But I think it comes from the top down, and because I cared so much.
Yeah.
Everyone else did too. They saw that I didn't have any other agenda but putting the best possible show we could. I wasn't an a-hole. I was just like, I would stay at the crappy hotel.
Right.
Just so we could have more money to put on the screen.
Yeah. Okay.
And when you do that, people respond to it. They're like, "Well, if he's doing that, I guess I better do it too."
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And so, I mean, it's kind of like leading by example, and everybody follows. Assuming you have the right people, then
they'll
follow.
Right. This next question comes from one of our listeners, Darby Campbell. She was wondering, there seems to be a consistent, and this goes back to the writing, there seems to be a consistent theme of stories having a moral. Was this a goal in the writing or a byproduct?
It's a goal. I think so. I think when you're, I mean, not to be, you know, it's not like after school specials.
Sure,
anything,
sure.
But I think any of these, if you go back to the Twilight Zone, they're all morality tales.
Oh, absolutely.
True.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's not just a boogeyman running around.
Right.
So there's got to be something, in the course of the story, in the course of the character story, there has to be something that these characters do that they make the wrong choice.
Right.
They make a mistake. They don't do what they should have done, and that leads to repercussions.
Sure.
And I think that is why I believe, toot my own horn, but I think that's what makes Are You Afraid of the Dark special.
Absolutely.
It isn't necessarily the monsters and the explosions and the spookiness. It's like all of these stories are about characters that you really cared about, who had stories that you wanted to know what happened to them, even if they didn't get involved with the Ghastly Grinner or the Boogeyman or whatever
right.
it is. And that's where the story has a little more resonance to it.
Sure,
where
yeah.
And they don't always come out to be happy endings, but But yeah.
Well, in speaking on that, two of our other listeners, Philip Maloney and Justin Graves, they kind of were wondering about the same thing. Philip asked, he said, you know, the show more often than not had a happy ending. Was there ever a time where you wrote something darker than made it to air? Or, you know, was Nickelodeon always insistent on happier material? Or how did that work?
Never.
Okay.
They never. Wow. The only pushback I got from Nickelodeon were on specific standards and practice things.
Uh-huh.
Like, you can't really say that. You can't really show that.
Sure.
Never from a global story point of view.
Okay.
I've never gone through that. We did 91 episodes. I never went through to figure out how many were happy endings and how many were not. But I'd say it's almost close to 50-50. There were a lot of not happy endings.
Sure.
I'll tell you one little fun thing is that there are 91 episodes. There are 91 campfires.
Right.
Not one. Did we ever show someone lighting that campfire?
Sure, yeah. Sure. I would imagine that has to do with safety, right?
Well, it has to do with imitatable behavior.
Sure. Yeah. Essentially, what I mean. Wow.
You don't want to show it. You don't want to teach a kid how to strike a match and burn down his house.
Sure.
not that they cared if a kid burned down a house. They just didn't want a kid to burn down the house and blame them.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly.
So the fact that you didn't get a lot of pushback, do you think that says more about the writing or more about Nickelodeon or both? Because, I mean, obviously Nickelodeon was showing a lot of things that might be considered risque, like, you know, maybe Pete and Pete or Ren and Stimpy. Or
Roundhouse, yeah. For that matter.
Roundhouse, sure. Those were, you should check out this book, Slime, because I'm going to say something that pretty much all the various, that book was done by interviewing all the creators of all the shows.
Oh,
back
wow,
then.
Okay.
And we all pretty much said the same thing, which is they let us make the shows.
Sure.
There wasn't that. It wasn't until around, and I know exactly when it happened. It was like 1994. The change was that Nickelodeon started to make money.
Right,
yeah.
And as soon as they started to make money, there started to be more oversight.
Sure.
And I knew, like, for example, that guy I told you who pulled the three-page thing out of Are You Afraid of the Dark or Scary Tales?
Right.
And said, why aren't we making the thing? He wasn't there much longer.
Right.
Because he was kind of out there. He had a creative vision. He was replaced by a guy who was much more down the line. I won't mention his name.
Sure.
And boring.
Right.
Became much more cautious, much more safe. And I look at Nickelodeon today, and it's just like, whoa, what happened?
I mean, it's you know, I guess kind of jumping ahead, the landscape of television today, you would never see a block of programming like the original SNCC lineup.
And whoever that guy was, whoever that woman was, I guess I was a woman, actually, who came up with that idea, who said, you know, there's a group of, Saturday night is the no man's land of TV. However, there's a group of people who are too old to be in bed, too young to be on a date.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And there's SNCC. And it was and between a sitcom, comedy variety,
right,
irreverent animation, and scary, it's like in that two-hour block,
you had everything. It
just doesn't exist on TV
anymore.
Right, and much the same way that about, 10 years ago now, somebody was like, there's a bunch of people who have just graduated high school and they're still up and they're very high and they need cartoons to watch, and you have Adult Swim.
Adult Swim, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
I mean, do you think, you know, to kind of build onto that, the last question, I mean, do you think it'll ever get back to a point where we, you know, have material like that?
I don't know. I think we as a nation have become so conservative that I watched, the other day, I watched one of my old shows. I watched The Tale of the Midnight Madness. And there was one scene in there where this guy, besides the fact that I have an interracial couple in the show.
Sure.
There was a guy, this theater owner, who was like swigging alcohol out of his hip flap and whatnot. That stuff, we are so conservative all of a sudden.
Right.
You know the old show, you can't do that on television? Well, now it's true.
Now it's true, sure.
You can't. I'll tell you one thing that goes beyond just the kind of society mores and whatnot, is that so much of what's on TV live action now are sitcoms, and the thing that we won't go back to is that sitcoms are way cheaper to produce.
Right.
Yeah, you set up 2 or 3 cameras and you get it done in, you know, working hours,
sure.
You know, 8-hour day or whatever.
To kind of go back to, you know, just the material. Justin Graves had asked, did the show ever experience any pushback or objections from parents groups regarding the content, however ridiculous or unfounded? It would seem that no program dealing in themes of horror ever escapes this fate, and considering that yours was aimed squarely at children, it's hard not to imagine that Are You Afraid of the Dark wouldn't have had a bullseye on its back throughout the entire run.
I'm telling you, it was just the opposite.
Wow, okay.
It was embraced. Now, that's not to say that there wasn't that concern in the beginning. Like right. I said, they told me to say, use literary antecedents.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that will be our argument.
Sure.
But no one ever came out against it. Now, at least, it's certainly not that I heard of. It never trickled down to me.
Right.
So if it didn't come to me, either they were deflecting it incredibly, which I doubt.
Right.
Or it just didn't happen.
Sure.
We got awards.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. Maybe parents weren't watching. I don't know.
Just a couple more questions before we hit up our lightning round. But Justin also had a couple of questions about the cast, which, you know, we know that you did a nationwide talent search. But also, you know, what was the reasoning behind the revolving door of the Midnight Society cast members? Was it an issue of the performers moving on for other work, or was it motivated by attempts to appeal to different ages, sexes, and ethnicities, or something else?
It was the former.
Okay.
It was back to the former. It okay. was, you know, we started at seven,
mm-hmm.
seven kids. In the second season, one of the kids, probably the most experienced kid there, was like, I want to be paid more.
Right.
We were like, bye-bye.
Yeah, sure.
One of the girls, who we also had as the star of one of our, of Crisscross.
Uh-huh.
We brought her to London, or to Nottingham to shoot Crisscross. She just called me up after two or three seasons, or I forgot, maybe it was two seasons, said, DJ, I just don't want to do this anymore.
Okay.
Okay, let's get somebody else in.
Sure.
Another guy essentially dropped out of the business.
Okay.
So it was never... The only... along those lines is when we came back on the air. We were off the air for 2 years.
Uh-huh.
We came back on the air. It was like, we need to get a younger cast.
Sure, sure.
Or no, we can't use the same cast
because they're, yeah.
They've got their own children at this point. So so that was the only time when there was a sea change.
Okay.
But mostly it was based on that. It was their decision.
Sure. Justin was also wondering, was there a concentrated effort to attribute certain kinds of stories to specific members of the Midnight Society? For instance, Betty Ann seemingly favors science fiction type tales. Was this assigning genres or subgenres to specific characters intentional? And was it a way to develop their characters more?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
100%.
Great.
Betty Ann, who was the meekest girl, always kind of had the twisted science fiction story.
Sure, sure.
David, who was in the first three seasons, who was kind of the meek guy, he always kind of had the story with heart to it.
Right.
Frank, who was the macho guy, he was Dr. Vink.
Okay.
Gary, who was the nerd, he was Sardo.
Sure.
So, but yeah, they always... in fact, when I did that hour-long episode, Tale of Carter's Treasure, I thought, how cool to have Dr. Vink and Sardo in the same episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one's Gary's character, one's Frank's character. I had them, they had to tell the tale together because they each had their own character. So, yeah, absolutely. They were attributed to do exactly as he described.
Right.
Great. We had kind of an additional thing when we were talking about just the landscape of TV in the early 90s. Was there anything else on Nickelodeon or any other channel for that matter that just kind of that inspired you or that you thought really, you know, maybe looking back on it recently has stood the test of time or you felt like was really a contemporary of yours?
You know something? I can say the same thing now about that I say about the books that I write now, mm-hmm. is that I have trouble watching the kind of stuff that I make.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
And it's because I'm not one of those guys who I better find out what the competition is up to or whatnot. It's like I don't do it for enjoyment. I want to watch things for enjoyment. And when I know all the tricks, I don't do it. I can't get enjoyment out of it.
So,
there are the little bits and pieces. I loved Ren and Stimpy. that was groundbreaking.
Right,
That style of animation, my God, that style of animation is pervasive now on television.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I would say probably that show more than any else has not just not so much withstood the test of time, but really created a style of animation and storytelling that didn't exist before that.
Sure. Yeah. You're welcome, SpongeBob.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I guess we'll do our lightning round. These are just kind of, you know, a series of questions you don't have to spend a whole lot of time on, but they're just, you know, kind of quick questions.
Okay.
What were some of the most challenging episodes, either writing or directing?
Pinball Wizard was the most challenging.
Okay.
Hmm.
That took longer to shoot than any other episode, and that nearly killed me and my budget.
Sure.
I actually had a boat of the crew to work an extra night because it went against all sorts of union rules.
Oh, no.
And they had to vote unanimously to agree to it. That's proof of how good that crew was. They all voted in. Yeah. Sure, we'll work another night. That show nearly killed me. That one stood out more than any.
Wow. We know the answer to this question, but for our listeners who might not, what was the Midnight Dust?
Oh, it was non-dairy creamer.
Okay.
The non-dairy creamer is petroleum-based, and it burns. Now, we also added a little pyrotechnic in the fire, so it wasn't. The whole explosion was a non-dairy creamer, but yes, it was not a dairy creamer.
Where were the buffers shot, you know, the Midnight Society buffers?
In a soundstage in Montreal.
Okay.
Wow.
One of the challenges for me in the show was that we had to shoot them all at the same time, because you're not going to build that forest more than once, or maybe sometimes we did it twice. So I had to know what all the scripts are going to be going into a season. Because the campfires weren't, we have a really scary story tonight, and it's about a really scary thing.
Right.
The bit of your approval, the tale of really scary things. We had to know what all the stories are going to be. So that put pressure on me to get the scripts done.
Yeah.
Sooner than I normally.
So, additionally, I heard that there was an interesting story working with Bobcat Goldthwait. Could you elaborate on that at all?
Well, Bobcat was in an episode called The Tale of the Final Wish that I wrote and directed. And acting is hard.
Right.
and memorizing lines is hard. And if you're doing a scene, usually the scene is, if someone says to you, how are you doing today? That's the trigger for you to remember your line should have something to do with, how am I doing today?
Right.
Well, the dialogue I wrote for The Sandman was totally nonsensical, did not relate to anything.
Right.
And Bobcat was having trouble remembering the lines. The poor guy. And so on top of that, the voice that he used to do in his act, is put on. He didn't speak that way normally.
Right.
So he had to do so many takes. He was tearing his throat apart. Poor guy. Oh, my God. And at insult to injury, the little girl he was working with, who was an absolute sweetheart. Now, little girls still have all their gray cells.
Sure.
So she would sit there and just say, okay, I say this, and then you say this. And then I say this, and then you say this. So she had the whole script memorized, and he'd just look at her like, okay, kid, get out of here. But he was such a trooper, and he didn't give up, and he kept doing it. Oh, he had so much trouble. So, yeah, that was a rough one for him.
One of our other listeners, Matt Scott, he was wondering what your favorite character has been on the entire run of the show.
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, because 99% of the characters are only in once.
Sure.
So it's kind of hard to develop an affection. So I guess, you know, not counting the Midnight Society, it would have to be either Dr. Vink or Sardo.
Sure. Well, we're going to be talking to Richard about his performances. Mr. Sardo, we actually talked to him earlier today, and he wanted us to say hello on his behalf.
he was, talk about a find. That's, oh my God. I wrote this character.
Sure.
And I didn't direct the first episode he was in. It was called The Super Specs. Mm-hmm. It was Ron Oliver directed it. And this is a real example of how things build, talk about teamwork, is that as soon as I saw the kinds of stuff that he could do with Sardo, that gave me more ideas about what to write about Sardo.
Sure.
So it just kept building and building and building and building. Oh, it was so much fun. So much so that when I wrote an Are You Afraid of the Dark feature for Paramount that never got off the ground, unfortunately. I just read it recently again, and it's actually pretty good. I was surprised. I'm like, wow, this is good. But it was a Sardo story.
Okay.
I want to bring it back for the feature.
Did you have a favorite monster, even if it was for one episode, just one monster that really stood out to you?
The one that just jumps to mind was the vampire in The Night Shift.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was a really great design. Yeah.
Great looking design, and plus the fact that he morphed into normal looking characters.
Sure.
That was just insidious, I thought. So I thought that was pretty cool. Oh, either that or maybe the monster in the basement of the Dark Music. She never actually saw him.
That episode, I'm not going to lie, that episode is still pretty creepy.
Well, it is. I got the idea where I was in my friend's basement in Larchmont, New York, and each had this little doorway to nowhere.
Oh, God.
So what's in there? Goes, oh, you don't want to go in there. And I was like, well, what if everybody had a doorway to nowhere and there was a monster in there? And talk about insidious. I mean, fly at the end of that episode.
Right.
A, he got the monster to eat the bully, but then you get to think that he's going to feed his little sister to
this
thing, too.
Yeah, exactly.
I've
read that your favorite episode is actually also my favorite episode. Midnight Madness, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
That episode is just, I mean, it's an incredible, just an incredible story. I mean, can you talk a little bit about just how that episode came to be?
It's my favorite for a lot of reasons. I mean, I don't know if it's the best one. It could be, but I don't know if it's the best one. In fact, I just watched it the other day, as I said. It had a literary antecedent. Literary antecedent was the Pied Piper of Hamlet.
Okay.
The story about the guy that comes to town to play the flute to get rid of the rats of this town.
Sure.
The town is overrun by rats, the town of Hamlin. Mm-hmm. It's overrun by rats. They can't get rid of the rats. Piper comes to town, mysterious Piper, and says, I'll get rid of your rats, but then you have to give me whatever he said you got to give me. I forgot. So he plays the pipe. He gets rid of all the rats. And the people in town are like, we're not going to give you whatever we said we're going to give you. So instead, he steals all their children.
No.
So that's the tale of Midnight Madness.
Sure.
So, one of the reasons it's my favorite is because we did that episode. I wrote and directed that one. It was the beginning of the second season, and second season of television shows are the best because everyone is really excited. Oh my gosh, we're so good! We got picked up again for second season. No one's sick of doing the show yet,
right?
Because we've gone through the process of learning, and I'm talking about crew now, of learning what everyone can do. Suddenly, a shorthand exists,
right?
Where we can say, hey, we can do this. Hey, how about this? Now, the guy who was a good friend of mine before then, but he didn't work on the first season. He worked on seasons 2 through 5, who's the post-production producer and produced all of the visual effects on the show.
Uh-huh.
He had such a stamp on that show because he and the artist, Denny Arcand, worked so hard. Not Denny Arcand. I forgot Denny's last name. I'm sorry. Forget Denny Arcand. Denny was his name. Worked so hard in creating these effects. I mean, the technology didn't exist back in those days to do the kind of stuff that we did. And they're making this stuff up as we're going along. And the way they did that movie screen, the way that the kid walks into the movie screen. And today, you know what that guy's producing?
What's that?
He's got a couple Emmys for producing all the effects for Game of Thrones.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
We actually, just before the interview, we were catching little clips of that episode, and that's exactly what, you know, the part where he steps into the screen, and I was just thinking, this looks fantastic.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's so many things within the show that still stand the test of time, and I think that speaks to, you know, so much of the show.
Actually, going back to the Anique, the makeup artist,
uh-huh.
there were four, there was an article written about this shortly after the episode was on, but there are four times in film history that makeup style was used. One was the original Nosferatu, which is where it came from. Then there was the remake of Nosferatu in the 70s, I think. There was Stephen King's Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
And then there was Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Wow.
We used that Nosferatu makeup, and that was Anik's creation completely.
And it's such a, it's a great take, you know, because it's different, you know, with the veins and just the teeth and everything. I mean, it's just such a different take on it, but it's still instantly recognizable.
I just showed it to a friend of mine the other day, and we zoom into his face with those teeth,
right.
And he's just like, "Dude, you're what is with you? That is nasty."
But it was horrifying. So it was great.
This is a kids show.
Kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, and we just have a couple more questions. Was there ever an episode, you know, even now, that just doesn't work for you, that you wish you could have done something different with?
Oh, many. Those shows, it's like any show. It's like a bell curve of quality.
Right.
Where on one end are the great episodes and the other end are the really bad episodes. And everything else kind of fits in the middle. There was, oh boy, I can't say this because it's going to air. There was I'll say it. Don't make me say the name.
Okay.
There was one out of the 91 episodes we did. There was one episode that, in its rough cut form, was unwatchable.
Okay.
And it was unwatchable principally because of the lead character.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, the actor just didn't get it. Just oh my god, it was like watching paint dry. Oh, it was horrible.
Oh no.
So and of all times we're dead. I don't know what we're going to do with this thing. Oh my god. Fortunately, with editing, with cutting some stuff out, with music, you know, we were able to make it into an okay episode.
Sure.
And this is going to be a total tease that I'm not going to pay off on, but that guy went on to be a really big star.
I think I probably know what episode it is.
Iconic character that he played.
Okay, sure. We're going to go back and do some rewatching then.
don't make me say anything.
Okay.
I'm thinking this guy's never going to work again. Oh, look what job he got.
This makes me think, and I don't want to get into a huge discussion about it, but it's another director or just film cliche in general. Don't work with kids. Was there a time where you were like, oh, that's why they say that? Or did you never look back?
Wait, say that again? Ask the question again?
So, you know, a lot of times you hear that there are a couple rules, like don't work with kids and don't work with animals. Something to that effect. Was there ever a point where you were like, okay, that's why they say that? Or did you ever, or did you just never regret it?
Oh, no, all the time. Okay. I mean, it's water, animals, airplanes, and kids.
Sure.
Okay. Those are the four deadly ones. And there were plenty of times where I was like, oh my gosh. And you know what really is hard? And it's not so much because of the kids, because as a director, I was always able to work with the kids, and I never had any real problems. Didn't always get the greatest performance, but I never had any real problems. Where I have had problems, it's with, unfortunately, with working rules.
Sure.
Because kids can only work a certain amount of time, and it's like, yikes, we got to get this, we got to get it now.
Right.
I didn't really have that much an Are You Afraid of the Dark, because, quite frankly, the kids were in and out in 1 week, and we kind of did what we had to do, and if we got it done, there was no problem. But when you're working on shows where you're coming week in and week out, you can't do that. It's wrong to do that.
Yeah.
Those times where I'm like, oh my gosh, somebody bring me an adult. It's not because the kid wasn't doing a good job, it's because the kid had a tutor who was saying they're off the clock in 5 minutes.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I've had them. When I did Flight 29 Down, it was like that.
Right. Have there been, because I'm sure a lot of fans want to know, have there been any plans or talks to finally release an authorized, you know, Blu-ray or DVD set of the show?
If there have been, I'm not privy to them.
Okay.
It's really kind of an amazing thing, because the way the show's set up is that it's Nickelodeon owns the domestic rights.
Right.
This company, we made it with a company called Cinar that doesn't exist anymore. Now it's owned by a company called Cookie Jar, I think. They have the foreign rights. So I don't know why Nickelodeon has never decided to do a full bust out release of the show.
Sure.
Like on DVD. I'm also surprised they don't air it more often.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it, you know, is just now there's this resurgence of retro Nickelodeon, and you get them every now and then. It's kind of incredible to me. I mean, because especially this time of year, you think you would want to, you know, keep revisiting it, but it would seem like a no-brainer, but here we are, you know?
Well, in years past, they have.
Sure.
I don't know, maybe they just think it's so old that it's not worth it, but they have 15 different channels now, so right. I really am surprised that they don't air it more often, and for guys like you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I mean, I would gladly watch it again.
I like all that, and to a much, much lesser extent, the Amanda Bynes show, but I would much, much rather see Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Sure.
And we should also note that this isn't particular to your show. Nothing's on DVD from Nickelodeon.
No, I mean, Pete and Pete, you know, Clarissa explains it all. None of the shows we grew up with are really available.
Pete and Pete, you can get the first two seasons, not the third. But
right.
Most of the Nicktoons aren't available.
Right.
It's a travesty, really. I mean,
I don't know if it's a residual thing, if it's a unit, because I'm certainly not getting any residual.
Sure.
I'm not getting a dime off of that show. So I had the Canadian company actually put out the first five seasons on DVD.
Okay.
And I had to buy them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's how bad it is. So,
if there was ever any plans, I mean, to do a set, would you ever want to do, like, commentary and that kind of thing?
Oh, in a heartbeat.
Awesome.
I mean, I'm telling you, I talk about, today's a good example, I talk about that show more today than I did when it was on.
Sure.
there isn't a day that goes by that I don't answer a question about Artie Franklin.
I mean, does that get old for you, or do you still enjoy talking about it?
Oh, no, I love it. I've been on the phone with you guys for an hour.
Yeah, that's true. and we're glad to have you. Two more questions. Have there ever, you know, you kind of mentioned that there was plans for a movie at one point. I mean, have there ever been any talks to reboot the series?
Series, no.
Okay.
Certainly no one's talked to me about it.
Sure.
I did see that there's a new spooky series coming out on Nickelodeon. But I don't think they're producing it. I think they're licensing it from New Zealand or something like that. I don't know if they would do it if they 100%, they being Nickelodeon, owned it 100%.
Sure.
Because they don't. They only own 50% of it. So I did try to resurrect the movie a year or so ago. Because I went back and I read the script and I was like, you read something you wrote a long time ago, and Jushi's like, oh my God, that's horrible.
Right.
But I read it and it's like, oh my God, this is good.
Right.
And so I had my management company bring it into Paramount and whatnot to say, hey, you've been looking for this stuff. It's like, here's someone you already own.
Right.
You bought it about 10 years ago. And it's never got any traction. So I don't quite get it.
No, and, you know, neither do I. I mean, you know, there's currently a Goosebumps movie in production, and, you know, you would think, I mean, if there's a market for that, then there's definitely a market for an Are You Afraid of the Dark movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
for real.
And the possibilities are endless, you know. I mean, it just could,
you know.
I know
something, I think it goes back to what we're saying before about how, you know, the kind of the death of Nickelodeon was created creatively. It's
right.
Like, I don't think people there are that farsighted.
Sure.
I just don't think it's there.
Hmm.
And if I had stay over it, it would happen, but I don't.
Right, naturally. To kind of wrap up, you know, a lot of the listener questions we've got, just to go over some of the names, Matt Scott, he's a special effects makeup artist. Brittany Jade Colangelo, she runs a blog called Day of the Woman, and she's a horror writer. Justin Graves runs a site called The October Country. And even us, you know, we're filmmakers now. I'm also a special effects makeup artist and concentrate on horror films a lot of the time. You know, I mean, the show has definitely influenced what I wanted to do with my life. Brittany Jade had said, you know, this is a direct quote from her. She said, "Thanks for giving me a sense of solace that I was cool when other kids teased me for loving horror." And one of our other listeners, Darby Campbell, she said, "Thank you for the introduction to safe horror and the idea that young people could be storytellers." Having done the show and had a very popular series of books, you know, in the Pendragon series, what's it like knowing that you've shaped, you know, more than one generation of people?
You know, it's funny you ask that, because I just had this conversation with someone the other day where it's, when you're in the middle of doing something,
mm-hmm.
all it is work.
Sure.
You know, it's as hard as, like, oh my God, how am I going to get this done? And it isn't until something is done and finished and you can kind of look back on it. You know, all the wounds have healed.
Right.
Then you kind of look back on it. And right now, if I died today, I mean, I've done a boatload of things.
Sure.
But if I died today, there are two things going to be on my tombstone: Are You Afraid of the Dark and Pendragon.
Sure.
And hopefully there'll be more on there at some
point.
But it's kind of a good feeling. I had a woman come up to me at a book event the other day, talking about an adult talking about Pendragon. This wasn't who I remember you as a kid. This is I just read this last year.
Sure.
Where she was in tears talking about what Pendragon meant to her, and you know, on the thematic level and what it taught her. And it's like, wow, you know, it's sometimes you have to stop, take a step back and say, yikes, I really touched somebody here. And that's pretty cool. That's a great feeling. I mean, it's so easy to get caught up in just the business of it and it's work and, oh God, I got to get this done. But really, it's a really great feeling to know that on some level you've influenced people. Like you say, you got into doing special effects makeup.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, I'm thrilled. I really am thrilled to know that, because a lot of times you do these things and you don't ever think that anyone's actually watching them.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you actually watched that show? You read my book? I thought that was just for me and my publisher. I didn't know.
It's funny that, you know, when we were first planning on doing the show, you know, I was looking up your information and I found your website and I found that you were going to be in Memphis that night. And we're about 4 hours away from Memphis. And it was still one of those things where it was like trying to find people who wanted to drive to Memphis just to, you know, just to be able to meet you and say thank you. You know, I mean, it's just the show still means a lot to a lot of people.
It's true.
I get that sometimes. I had one, and this is books now, but not movies. There was a woman who came to a book signing of mine a couple of years ago, and she drove a couple of hours to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, She said, I had to come and meet you because I want you to know my story. So when I was growing up, I was severely dyslexic.
Right.
I really couldn't read. The breakthrough book for me was my book, Merchant of Death. That's the one that got me interested in fighting through to get it done.
Wow.
And now I'm a college English major.
Wow.
That's huge.
And I was like, oh my God. And I was just back in Dallas the other day. She came back again. She graduated.
Right.
So it's like, oh my God, this is... And luckily she lived close by, so she'd
sure,
try for
sure.
But it was just like, I'm just moved by this stuff. And it's a really, I don't know what else to say, but it's a really, really good feeling. And I'm thrilled to hear about it too,
right.
Because it makes me feel that it's really, it's just worthwhile. It's not just a job sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that about wraps it up for us. You know, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. You know, this show it's been a task to put it together and get everybody together to do it. But we're so glad that, you know, we were able to finally get a chance to talk with you, and thank you so much for your time.